Go ahead and start. Good morning, everybody. It is March 16th.
Already?
It's kind of in between the Ides of March and St. Patrick's Day. And we are here on a fine Monday morning, having survived the rainy, windy weekend. Doug.
Mr. Chair, members, it would be nice to get through this today, but there are about 100 slides left, so I doubt if you can. We will be having public testimony again tomorrow, and we are in room C, I believe, but check the schedule. Julie, is it C tomorrow?
C, yes.
Okay. And if there's not a full hour or hour and a half of public testimony, we'll have the agency back and continue through. And as soon as they're done, we'll have Higher Education Coordinating Commission on deck,
okay.
Hopefully on maybe part of Wednesday and Thursday or Thursday.
Okay. And Representative Taylor is stuck in San Francisco. If ever you have flown and been in the San Francisco airport, you can understand her dilemma. But anyway, I'm sure she will be here tomorrow. Okay, Mr. Saxon.
Yes, Co-Chair Compton Monroe, members of the committee, Rob Saxon, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction. I think that we handed out the list of questions that we were asked on Thursday. I believe there were seven of them. The first was, what's the Great Start program? And it's a program that invests in community-based programs for children 0 through age 6, working to improve outcomes for children and families. And they use research-based programs and beyond that have a fair degree of flexibility. So that's what Great Start is. The second one was, what federal funding is available for summer schools? And there are several different federal funds available for summer schools, including USDA's Summer Food Program and 21st Century Community Learning Centers and Migrant Education Programs. Third question was, what are other funds in the state school fund budget?
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Rob, on our printed pieces, it has, looks like there's a PDF file attached to this printout. Doug, do we have those? Do we have this on our
I think it's been sent to us. If not, we'll get it. Is it also attached?
Co-Chair Cobb, I believe it's also attached.
Okay.
Back that shows some of the stuff that was part of the PDF.
Okay,
I'll keep looking. Thank you.
Sorry, and I can reference those as we go along. The other funds, I think that was a question for Brian, and it says that there's a small amount of state timber taxes, which is about $400,000 received by ODE, and a transfer from the state school fund to the local option equalization grant account of about $3.5 million. Number four was, will school districts receive transportation reimbursement for summer school and or extended day school under the literacy initiative? And the answer is that we have proposed amendments to Senate Bill 214 that would allow for that. The fifth was...
But currently it's not.
Co-Chair Monroe, that's correct. Currently, in its current form as it's written, it is not. We do have proposed amendments that would have it be so. Number five, please provide ADMW amounts for each school district so members can see the comparisons. And that was from Representative Comp, and there's a attachment, one of the pages, it's about the fourth page back, that provides that list. Number six was, how many districts are using the fifth year at the high school level? It's hard for us to know exactly. We asked districts to do a different coding for students who had done everything they needed to earn a high school diploma, but were not granted one in a new way this year. They weren't required to, but most wanted to, because then it would help them count as graduates in a four-year cohort. What the code is not that important, the 4F code, but that's what it is. And about five pages back, you'll see that we estimate that there are 1,201 fifth-year diploma students last year that were coded that way. Now, there may be some other There may be some other districts that are doing this, but we're not certain. And the cost is somewhere in the neighborhood of what, $9.5 million, I think, is what the total is back here, Brian?
Correct. Co-chair Comp. The new coding, the 4F code that identifies those students, isn't required until the end of this year, the 14-15 school year, but a number of districts started using it last year, so that's where we get the 1,201 students. Those are ones where students actually use the code at the end of 13-14, indicating the number of kids coming back for a fifth year in this current year. We think that not all school districts who could have used that code last year actually did so. So in trying to identify other districts that have fifth-year students, we look at students who were in the 12th grade at the end of 13-14 and then were still enrolled at the end of the following school year. So they did a fifth year. Now, some of those students might be students who hadn't completed their diploma requirements at the end of the prior year. So that's the uncertainty involved in there for those districts that didn't use the new code. We're not absolutely certain, but there may be a few hundred more students who actually are fifth-year students, but we can't positively identify them yet.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you. Well, Brian, I really appreciate your work on this because I know 4 or 5 years ago I asked you this exact question, and it was like I couldn't read your mind, but you're probably thinking, I think Representative Comp's kind of out to lunch, but but I had heard of a few schools, and I'm not surprised that it's become more prevalent.
Co-Chair Comp, yeah, I was thinking about how we could identify right. those districts and those students back then, and the answer is we don't really have a good way of doing that, and that's why we implemented this new code. This
right.
was something that was not anticipated in our data systems, that these students would be coming back after they completed their diploma requirements.
Follow up.
Go ahead.
Because I know there really wasn't any way to, you know, calculate it at all a few years ago, so I really appreciate your work on that.
Go ahead. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So, Brian, as we look at some of these, and I would assume because it says on page 3 of the fifth-year document, students still enrolled 12 months after anticipated graduation. So we're not talking about students who are going another term or so, their first fifth year to graduate, that they certainly, we assume, have. As we look at these numbers and students that are getting that first year basically paid for, do we have any data that indicates how many of those students continue on in college, that's a gateway to actually get a two-year degree? Because I think that kind of aligns with 40-40-20 as far as getting kids 20% graduated, 40% either a two-year degree or a trade.
Co-Chairs Monroe and Comp, Representative Springer, we do have the ability with what's called the National Student Clearinghouse data, which is a national organization that collects data from all the 2- and 4-year colleges in the country, and we can match our high school graduate data against their data to see where our kids went to college and how well they're doing in college. But these students were just able to identify the fifth-year students now. We can, when we match them now, we see them attending community colleges in Oregon in their fifth year. Since we don't have good data early enough yet, we can't follow them all the way through college yet to see if they persist or to see if they graduate from college, but we'll be able to do that in a few years.
Follow up.
So drilling down in a few years, do you think this is a number we're going to be able to see maybe in 2 years? Obviously not the 4-year bachelor's degree, but certainly an associate's or the certificates.
Co-Chairs Monroe and Comp, Representative Springer, I think so. I mean, if you think about fifth-year students, if the typical path is that their fifth year of high school, that they earn, you know, a year's worth of college credits in a community college, and then continue a second year in community college and earn an associate's degree or a certificate, mm-hmm. we should be able to see that next year.
Great.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Brian, I'm glad to hear that, that it could be as soon as that. I would like to have seen it now. There was, you know, I got a study done, a work group came out of it for the opportunity grant, and for me this is kind of along those same lines. If we're spending state school funds, if districts are being creative in getting state school funds, $9.5 million in the scheme of things is not huge, but it's a lot of money in my checkbook. And I think it was the Oregonian over the weekend did an editorial on this topic. And you know, if we don't come up with a policy, which is going to be a question I have, and a couple of the larger district schools jump in, that $9.5 million is probably going to pale in comparison. And I think we need to figure this out pretty quickly here, formula-wise. Is it fair? Is it not fair? Is it something we're going to allow? Is it, how are we going to approach this? I've talked about it a couple of years ago, and it sounds like maybe we're a little bit closer. But Mr. Chair and Madam Chair, my question is, do you all know of a work group or a study that's being done to look at this, to help us come up with an answer of what is right, what is wrong, what are we going to support?
Madam Co-Chair?
The only comment I would make, Representative Huffman, and several of, well, we had a funding task force group this past, between the last session and this one, and it's interesting because whenever you bring a group of people together on these topics, what they find out is it's pretty dense to get through it. And so Senator Devlin, who chaired the meeting, we came out with only one recommendation at that time, and we did not even, well, it was, this subject was brought up, but we didn't have the time to get into it. Several superintendents brought it to, you know, brought it to our attention, but the only thing that we reached agreement on was the children that had high cost disabilities. And again, the consensus was, well, we need another work group. But having been part of work groups for some time, I don't know what the best answer is. This topic definitely needs to be investigated, and I don't have the best recommendation at this time to say how we could do it.
Senator Roblin.
A couple questions, if I may.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
I thought you had the solution.
Well, I wish I had the solution, because I think it, what I'm going to do is only add more, a little bit more frustration. In our education committee a while back, we had a conversation with, I think Chalkboard brought in some people to talk about graduation rate, and how when you look, we get compared nationally on our graduation rates and attendance and all those other kinds of things, and what we found was a whole lot of the information that we have is not done the same way it is in other states. And so we don't count necessarily, haven't counted people who've completed the GED. Other states do. We don't. I mean, and now we've got this 12th year, we've got X number of kids who theoretically met all the requirements, but they didn't graduate. So when we get compared to other states with respect to graduation rate, we look disproportionately low because of the fact that we don't do those kinds of things. So my concern is, since I don't think comparing state graduation rates is going to go away anywhere anytime too soon, or any of these other things, are we doing anything at this level or at the OEIB level with respect to making sure that our data is accurate, and that when we get the data from the school districts, if it looks really out of line, do we check back with them to find out what is happening with their graduation rates and all this other kind of data? And do we have a training program that really trains districts so every district is doing it the same way? I mean, so we can actually have confidence in the numbers that we're having, because we make a lot of decisions based on those numbers about who we are, what we are, and how we're moving forward. And if we don't really know what it stands for, it makes it frustrating for us. So I was just wondering if we're doing anything about that, if OEIB is doing anything about that, if that's a part of the conversation.
Co-chairs Kaufman, Senator Roblin, the last two pieces, yes, we check districts' data when it comes in and make sure that it looks reasonable, and we also send it back to them and say, this is what we just got from you. Would you verify that it's what you meant to send us? So we do a couple different things to make sure that that's happening. We also do some training to help districts calculate things in similar ways. When it comes to the graduation rate, this is an issue we actually fixed this year. So the new code, this 4F code, was one for us to say, if you've done everything that you need to do to earn a high school diploma, and you even participated in the graduation ceremony, they just never gave you the piece of paper because you wanted to have a fifth year paid for, you graduated, and we're going to count you as a graduate. And it bumped up our graduation rate by probably 2%, somewhere in that ballpark. I think as we more appropriately calculate, recognize the numbers of students who are doing this, it may bump it up a little bit more. I do think that there's a problem between the way we calculate our graduation rate and the way other states do. We've been having some meetings about that. We have a new internal auditor at the department. We've asked the internal auditor to do an audit of our calculation rate and the calculation rate of other states, how other states do it. We also have begun to work with the Education Commission of the states and said, could you compare how we do our graduation rate to the way that other states calculate their graduation rate, so that we have an outside the state group who would make this demand? Because as soon as I ask someone to look at, as soon as I say that we're calculating it wrong and that we're going to fix it, there'll be some articles in the paper that say that we're cooking the books, and we don't want to do that. So we need somebody from the outside to do this for us, and the Education Commission of the States is lined up to do it. And I think what we'll find, we'll find that some states calculate their graduation rates significantly different, and that some even count GED, which the feds explicitly said that we could not do. When we were asked to turn in our technical papers about how we were going to calculate this, when there was supposed to be a common format, we sent it into the U.S. Department of Ed, and they accepted it without revision, which tells us that we probably were really, really too technically precise, because we didn't have to fight with them at all. And I think other states pushed back a lot. And so we're really concerned specifically about what we call the denominator. It is how many students have ever existed in the system, because we require that if a student goes someplace else, that we get proof back that they've gone that other place prior to exiting them from the system, which gives us lots of students who have been here. And when you compare the number of students that went away as compared to the way other states calculate it, Texas, just to pick one, Texas doesn't require that. And so students move back and forth between Mexico and Texas all the time, which is probably part of the reason that they haven't done that. But they have a much smaller denominator by percentage than we do, and surprise, their graduation rate is about 15% higher than ours. And, I just don't think that they're performing at that much higher level than we are. And I actually think that we probably are in the 7-8% range as far as challenging ourselves. But we'll find out, and I think that we'll have a pretty good idea about this prior to next fall.
Go ahead.
Yeah, the follow-up has to do with freshmen. A number of, as I understood it, states, when a person starts at the high school level, that's when they first really care about what the previous transcript was. And so kids that move during that year, oftentimes we don't get a record request, so we assume they're coming to us, and we don't take them off our list for a while because the school that got them didn't need the records from before. Sometimes they'll ask, sometimes they don't, is what we found. Because we tried to check up a couple times and found that they were happily at school someplace else outside of the state. And so we tried to correct those as much as we could because it was very frustrating to us. So I appreciate that you're looking at that, and I recognize that at these different transition times there is a need for the record, and other times there isn't as much a need for the record, and so we lose kids, even though they're still going to school someplace else. So let's comment more than anything else.
Okay. Co-chairs Kaufman and Monroe, I'll get to number seven. I guess the last thing I'd say about fifth-year program is that I have become concerned over the past year that we don't have particularly robust juniors and senior years in our high schools. And it doesn't make sense to me to have a less than robust junior and senior year when kids could be earning college credit, and then turn around and give them a fifth year and have that money come out of the state school fund as well, and then have them earn community college credit in that fifth year, when perhaps what we could do would be to have a really robust junior and senior year where kids are earning high school credit and college credit, oftentimes as much as a full year of college credit, and then matriculating to community college. It just seems like an overall more efficient way to get the work done. If a student falls behind, or if they have a unique schedule at their high school, there are some complications with that, and I do agree that it helps move us toward 40-40-20, but I do think it's very possible for students to have a more robust junior and senior year, especially if we could quit bleeding money out of the state school fund for fifth-year programs to some degree. Just leave it at that. Number seven was about English language learners and exiting.
Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I don't want to go very far down a rabbit trail because I think we're already on a rabbit trail, but it's a good one. So how do you, big question, so let's kind of do short answer because we could debate this for a couple hours. How do we create a more robust, at least senior year? And I have a senior and he has one free period because mom said you can have one free period. But I know lots of parents who said this is the year they get to take it easy. So how do we address that and create that unless we are willing to raise even more? And one of my districts has a higher than state number of credits required for graduation. Right. How do we do that without that?
Co-chairs Kaufman and Monroe, Representative Springer, great question. There are two ways that I think we can do that. One is that we begin to offer as many college-level courses as we can in the junior and senior year so students have something they really want to take and they recognize will diminish college cost, get them down the pathway. And if there were lots of awesome classes for me to take as a senior, I'd be interested in taking them. So that's one way. Another way is that we change the requirement around instructional hours, which the state board just did. So the state board just took action to require that, and when I say just, I believe it was a month and a half ago, took action to say that in order for a school to be standard in Division 22, or district to be standard, that, and this ramps in over time, 92% of all students in that district must be enrolled for the minimum number of instructional hours. And that will require that most high schools offer more to their juniors and seniors so that they get them to attend for at least 990 hours. So it's going to take a couple years for that to roll up, but I think it will be a game changer for us on robust junior and senior year.
Go ahead.
Quick follow-up. Would aid qualify? Because a lot of seniors are aid in a lot of classes.
Co-chairs Kaufman and Monroe, Representative Springer, you truly do have a high schooler because you know all the shit. So aid would not count in our current, the way that the rule is written, aid does not count. If the student was enrolled in a junior block course where they were getting some instruction about becoming an educator and they had certain kinds of, gave certain kinds of support to the teacher, it might. But the idea is
any of them do that.
there are a few schools that have that kind of program, Representative Springer, but I would agree that typical teacher aid, not so much. Okay. And that is not intended to count.
Thank you.
So number seven was about ELL and SPED. There's a graph on the back. This is not work that we have done. This is through a partnership with Oregon State University and one of their researchers, Dr. Karen Thompson, who's doing some wonderful work for us around ELL. And it shows what we have is a graph of the kinds of learning disabilities that ELL students are identified with. And then there's also a graph of reclassification. We do not have the kind of data, I think, Senator Roblin, that you were asking for, but we can go to work on trying to collect it. It will take a little bit of time to actually do that one.
That's all right. I'll find it.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just a reality check. It is now 9 o'clock, and we have yet to get to the first slide of the 100 we have left.
Well, how many do we still have left?
100.
Roughly 100.
Oh, you're no fun.
This committee asks a lot of questions, and they're good questions, but it does eat up our time. Why don't you go ahead?
Thank you, co-chairs Monroe and Cobb, members of the committee, Brian Reeder with Department of Education. I think we left off on with the beginning of the slides on the carve-outs from the state school fund. Those are monies that are taken off the top of the state school fund prior to the distribution of funds that goes out through the regular formula. And so we have some examples here. Speech and pathology program that provides training stipends to speech language pathologists and students of that in that field to get more of those. It's one of the occupations in our schools where districts are having trouble finding qualified candidates. It's $150,000 per biennium. We have a carve out for the talented and gifted program, $350,000 per biennium, and it provides funds to ODE for the development of a statewide TAG program. This is, I believe, relatively new. Mm-hmm. We do not have a weight in the regular formula for TAG students. 10th grade assessment contract. Maybe Rob can provide a little detail on this. It's our carve out from the ESD distribution to provide for some assessments in our school districts. It allows the school districts to use some national assessment firms to give them some additional assessments capability in the districts. The Oregon Virtual School District, which people always remind us it's not a school district at all. What the Oregon Virtual School District does is provide resources to our 197 school districts in the state to help them deliver online courses and content to their students. It's been at about $1.6 million per biennium for a while now. What the department has been very successful at doing is using those funds to leverage other resources. For example, we have formed a partnership with Google for them to provide resources in every school district in the state for free. And it is the staff at ODE that negotiates those agreements on the behalf of school districts with content providers and other software and virtual course providers. These are resources for teachers and for students. They come at no cost to the districts. It's, I think, one of the more successful examples of a public sector, the ODE, partnering with private online content providers in a very successful way.
Is that available to homeschoolers?
Co-Chair Monroe, I don't know the answer to that.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In 2009, we passed the 10th grade testing bill. And on the previous slide, you were talking about 10th grade testing, but I'm not sure that was the necessarily totally connected. Because it sounded like it was kind of in addition to or a carve out for certain districts to do something. Anyway, it reminded me. Do we still do the 10th grade testing that the 2009 bill called for?
Yes.
Every school district does it. And is there ever a report to let us know how that bill has worked? Are we getting the information for these students to help them that we had hoped to?
Co-chairs Compton Monroe, Representative Huffman. Yes, the testing is still underway, and it's PSAT for some districts, and some districts that are grandfathered in, it's the ACT, or the work keys, I can't remember the name of the pre-ACT test right now, but anyway, or the ACT. And yes, we do get good information and data back, and if you would like, we can put something together for you to see.
I'd like to know how that's going.
That we can do
if
that.
It's actually helping students further their last year or two.
Co-chairs Compton Monroe, Representative Huffman is a district who participated in that, as a superintendent in a district who participated in that. It was extremely helpful for us both as a district as we were thinking about where students were, what classes they might need to take in order to be successful once they graduated from school, depending on what it was that they decided to do. And then it also gave us great feedback about the courses that we offered and how well we were preparing students. The data was invaluable, and we sliced and diced it lots of different ways, and it caused us to make really some profound changes in the way that we delivered instruction to students district-wide, but especially once they got to high school.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, go ahead.
So, Rob, I mean, that's a great testimonial from you. Do you get information from districts that tell you similar stories that they're doing, or is it just kind of it's out there, they're doing it, and we hope it works?
Co-chairs Compton Monroe, Representative Huffman. I don't know the answer specifically. I believe that we collect some data on that, and I'll check with our folks and get back to you tomorrow if that's okay.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Senator Roblin.
Thank you. Just a quick one. On the Google and all these other groups that work through OBSD, do we have tight we have a bill in the regular session regarding information, student information. Do they collect information if they use the Google sites on the individual students, or do we have a good, tight information sharing program with that? Do you know?
Co-chairs Monroe and Comp, Senator Roblin, I don't know exactly how we go about security, but we take security around individual students very seriously, and so the bulk of the resources through the virtual school district, Oregon Virtual School District, are actually course content, and there really aren't any security issues with that. And I don't know specifically that there are any security issues whether individual students can be identified by Google in that process or not, but we can find that out.
Okay, that'd be great.
Okay.
Moving on, the next carve-out is what's called the Small School District Supplement Grant. This is sometimes confused with what we call the Small School Correction. This is in addition to the Small School Correction. Both of them were intended to give additional money to small school districts that have small schools, this one for high schools in particular. It was perceived that the small school correction for high schools was still not giving enough additional money to districts with really small high schools, and so this was created a number of biennia ago to provide some additional money. It's a relatively small amount. It's $5 million, and it's distributed on a per ADM basis.
This is called the Riverdale Slush Fund.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, that was my bill.
Representative
Please.
Huffman.
Where did that come from?
Brian, why don't you go ahead?
Okay, the next two, or I guess the next one, Youth Corrections Juvenile Detention Education Programs. We will talk more about these in a later part of the presentation, but there is money there from the state school fund, about $15 to $16 million. That is not all of the money that goes there, and you'll get some more information on that one later. Long-term care and treatment. Currently, those facilities are funded in a sort of a roundabout way. There's a carve-out from the state school fund. Then the department enters into contracts with providers, which then enter into contracts with the facilities that provide the services to these students. I believe we have a bill in the session to take ODE out as the middleman there, so that the school districts where these students live will work directly with the providers and not require that second contract in the middle there. Facilities grants, these are grants that were intended to provide additional resources to school districts that put in place new classrooms, either through new construction or remodeling buildings to add classrooms. When this was created under the provisions of the Constitution, school districts could not use bond money to buy things like computers or lab equipment or desks, things that were not considered intrinsic to the building. A couple of years ago, the voters altered our Constitution so that bond money can be used for those items now. You may recall that the legislature reduced the size of this carve-out in the last session from $25 million to $20
million. If I could, I'd just like to emphasize that the reason that this fund was created was because school districts couldn't use any bond money for certain kinds of purchases, and that no longer is the case. And yet this $20 million still exists in the state school fund as a carve-out. Sometimes people ask me, are carve-outs in the state school fund permanent? And I say, well, technically, no. They can be changed at any time, and yet here's one that appears to not have the same, serve the same purpose, or really to have a purpose, and it still exists. And it's $20 million.
So since the schools now, when they go for a bond, can fund desks and computers and so on as a part of that bond, is the purpose of that to serve school districts that can't pass a bond? I mean, why is that $20 million still there?
Co-Chairman Rowe, the only way that you get any money out of this is if you add new teaching square footage to your school or your district. And so I suppose if a district used general fund resources to create new square footage, which is happens at times, but it's fairly unusual, and typically only districts that have significant reserve accounts are able to pull something like that off, then there would be some resources that would add to their, to support outfitting the space, but that would be a very unusual event.
So districts that, let's say, can't pass a bond but need additional space because they're going to full-day kindergarten or whatever the reason being, and they can't pass a bond, could access some of this?
Senator Monroe, yes, they could if they, let's say that they decided they were going to bring in a portable building or something like that in order to make full-day K work this year. That would add teaching square footage, and then they could access
It would have to add square footage. They would have to add classrooms.
Yes, Co-Chair Monroe.
Yeah, okay, gotcha. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Have any districts recently accessed any of this money in addition to the bond money they passed that does pay for desks and equipment?
Co-Chairs Compton Rowe, Senator Springer, yes. This account is emptied every biennium because it goes out on a per square footage built over the course of the biennium. And so however much new square footage is added to school districts across the state, it goes automatically basically to the districts that added the square footage on a pro rata share of square footage. So it's never left wanting.
Go ahead.
Follow up. So the districts that can pass a bond measure, and I have some that can, are able to, in addition to paying for the square footage and the equipment, can also access additional dollars. But the districts that can't pass a bond can't access anything.
Co-Chairs Compliment, Representative Springer. I understand your point, and yes, anybody who adds square footage can access this resource, but it's very difficult to add square footage if you can't pass a bond. And districts, and I used to be in one, we could pass a bond, pass it so that we could outfit it appropriately, and get this money. Yes.
Thank you.
Senator Roblin.
So we have a bill now that'll be coming here, if we haven't already sent it, that has to do with helping districts pass their bonds by, and we didn't put a lot of money into it, but it basically said that we'll pay up to $4 million for small school, for smaller districts, and a maximum of $8 million. So, and they know up front that if they put out the bond, they're going to get some money to match their others. This money could be used there. We could shift that in the Ways and Means process to say this money would better be spent funding that program than it is necessarily funding that program. Is that what I'm hearing?
Co-chairs Kaufman, Senator Roblin, yes, there are many ways that this $20 million could be used. I know that there has been some consternation from this committee about that there's $60 million in lots of requests. And so any place where there's some money that exists that might be have a higher purpose, I thought I would take a second to point it out. I sort of apologize. I took us down this rabbit hole, but that would make it 80 instead of 60. So that's right. My hope. Thank you.
Well, that was going to be my next question is, can we take that money and use it for things that we think are of higher need?
Co-chairs Kaufman Monroe, that might be a better question for Mr. Wilson than for me, but I would imagine that...
well, we've already discovered that there's about $200 million of need for a $60 million allotment that the co-chairs have made available. And so, you know, $20 million could help us meet some of those needs. Mr. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, it would take a statutory change to change the purpose of this. And you did that. You reduced this by $5 million last session to go toward the Network for Quality Teaching and Learning. So it is doable, but you have to have a vote.
Okay. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You can bring this back tomorrow if you could. Confirm that I think District 21 for the Dalles may have accessed some of this money for the modulars to be able to implement full-day kindergarten. I just want to verify that. I think that's true. But and if you could tell me how much they received. Thank you.
Call your district.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Call your district.
Moving along, Mr. Reeder.
Thank you. The next two carve-outs are a couple of the larger ones that we have. The first is the high-cost disability grant. As you probably know, those grants are for districts who have special education students on whom the districts spend more than $30,000. And that amount is $18 million per year. There have been discussions about that, in particular in the school funding task force that Co-Chair Comp mentioned, to raise that amount right now. If there is more demand on that fund than there are funds, it is prorated. And right now, we are distributing around 40 cents on the dollar of claims on that fund. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, just as a note, the co-chair's budget assumes doubling this and took that into account in their creation of the number for the state school fund, or essentially doubling. I think it's they add $34 million.
Okay. Thank you.
The transportation grant is a little bit different in that it's the legislature doesn't set a given amount of money for that, but it depends on, it is a reimbursement program where we reimburse districts for their transportation costs, most districts at 70% of their qualifying costs, but districts that spend more per student on their transportation qualify for larger reimbursements, either 80% or 90%. The highest 10% spending districts get a 90% reimbursement. The next 10% highest get an 80%, and the remainder gets 70%. Currently, we distribute about $200 million. I believe that's.
I've looked at this in the past, and I think it's totally unjustifiable. The 70% ought to be a flat across the board. If they're spending more for transportation, they get more, but why should they get more plus a higher percentage? Doesn't make sense to me. If we were going to rewrite the formula, this is one place I would want to look. Okay. Senator Roblin.
So the districts that are in that 90% make up what percentage of the kids? Because my understanding was they were always the very small districts with a lot of territory. So you have very little actual dollars going out that one, but the people who have it have very long distances to pick up kids.
Co-chairs Monroe and Comp, Senator Roeberl, and that's correct. Some of these districts spend around $2,000 per student in their transportation systems. That's for every student, not just the ones they transport. So it's a big hit to their budgets. And so the logic there is that without a higher reimbursement, that the dollars remaining after they pay their transportation costs for a classroom would put them at a disadvantage. But you're correct. They are the smallest, typically geographically large districts that transport small numbers of students long distances.
I'm not saying anything. Let's move forward.
Co-chairs Kaufman Rowe, I try not to take us too far down a rabbit hole, but I feel the need to say something on this one. I apologize. And it simply is that it's really difficult. There are lots of difficult decisions that school districts need to make about how they spend their money. And sometimes, like reducing something, is really hard to do. If you cut any program, whatever, I'm not even going to pick one because it would make people nervous. But anything that you would reduce, you lose a little bit of something in a district. It's almost impossible to think about reducing anything having to do with transportation when you know that you're only going to get 30 cents. You're only going to have a 30-cent gain on the dollar. So if you decided you were going to cut a athletic program, you cut it, you recoup every dollar that you spent on it.
Yep.
If you're going to cut a music program, you recoup every dollar that you spent on it. Wouldn't be smart to do, but you could do it. If you cut something around transportation, you only get 30 cents on the dollar for what you did, or maybe 20 cents or 10 cents on the dollar. And so the need to be
efficient,
really efficient around this does not exist.
No incentive to be more efficient, really, or there's very little incentive.
There just is not.
And this has always troubled me.
If you have a person who does some maintenance on buses and they cost $50,000 a year to the district and you get a 70% reimbursement on that, that position will not be reduced. Other positions will be instead.
I suggest we move on.
Madam Co-Chair.
No, I'm not. Let's just.
Madam Co-Chair and I have talked about this in the past.
It is something that is troublesome, but we've got plenty on our plates. Let's go.
Okay. Just a few more carve-outs to talk about. The pediatric nursing facilities provides. Or covers the cost of educational services for students in pediatric nursing facilities. Again, an attempt to improve the services to those kids. About $5.3 million is the estimate for the cost in 15-17 biennium. There's only one facility, is my understanding, but some very high needs kids. And then the local option equalization grant is a program that provides grants to school districts who pass local option taxes and have relatively low assessed value per student, so that passing that levy, because they have low assessed value, requires a relatively high tax rate. So as an incentive to pass those levies, the state provides this grant to what are often called low wealth school districts who might otherwise not pass a levy. So it's an incentive to increase resources in those districts by encouraging the passage of those levies, similar to the program for capital construction that Senator Roeblin described a few minutes ago. It's an incentive to do that. In fact, that proposal was modeled to a great extent on this one here, The form of that proposal is very similar to this one, which has been quite successful. That's about $3.5 million per biennium, and actually has been growing as more districts pass those levies.
That one really makes sense to me. I mean, I happen to represent the David Douglas School District, or much of it, and it's one of the most property-poor districts in the state, yet fast-growing, and really difficult for them to pass any kind of a local option or a bond.
The carve-out for the Network of Quality Teaching and Learning is relatively new. Part of the strategic investment program, I believe. $33 million per biennium for investing in improvements in our teachers, which is really one of the keys to maybe the largest, the most important factor in improving education of our kids, is to make sure that every single student in Oregon has a high quality teacher in their classroom. This slide may be just a tad out of order. It's back to the transportation grant. It shows the growth over time. And as I suspected, that $200 million was per year, not per biennium. I think that's what this graph tells us. I think districts spend on the order of $300 million per year, and so the roughly 70% reimbursement is closer to $200 per year, not per biennium.
Is the percentage of the basic school formula that goes to transportation increasing?
Co-chair Monroe, I, off the top of my head, I don't know. I don't believe so, but I could provide that for you.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see what, you know, what those numbers are in terms of a percentage of the total amount in the fund.
I think what we do know is that in these recent years where budgets had to be cut dramatically, that transportation budgets were not cut as deeply as others. So in those years, transportation did go up as a percentage. Yeah. But as revenue increases here soon, as the economy recovers, I think that other spending, non-transportation spending, will then grow faster than transportation spending. It looks a lot more like a fixed cost. And as Rob mentioned, the incentives to save there are low or non-existent.
Yep. Okay.
And just to sum up, the carve-outs taken together represent about $500 million per biennium. The bulk of that, obviously, is the transportation reimbursement piece. And the department makes those payments along with the regular formula payments that we make each month to school districts. That process works extremely well. We have improved it substantially over the past decade or so that errors are at a minimum. Districts, we have adjustments at the end of the school year, and then at the end of the next school year, when all of the costs and revenues are known with certainty, those adjustments that are required have been diminished substantially as we get more accurate. So revenue is much more predictable for school districts, and they appreciate that very much.
And the transportation is based upon the previous year's spending, right?
Co-Chair Monroe, no, it is based on current year spending. As with everything else in the formula, as we start a new school year, we don't have actual data on everything yet.
Yeah.
So we make estimates to begin with, and those are typically made on prior year spending.
Ah, okay.
But sure. As we get more data as time goes by, then we switch over from estimates to actual data for all of the elements in the formula, okay. Some of them earlier than others, but eventually all of those.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Madam Co-Chair.
I have a question for Doug. This is considered phase one of the process, correct? And so in phase two, let's take the back on, what page is that, 187, the Network for Quality Teaching and Learning. In phase two, will we find out of that $33 million, how many teachers were mentored, how will we get reports back on the outcomes of the use of that $33 million? That's my question in phase two.
Madam Chair, I've just added to the list of the phase two topics I have ongoing here. So, and I'm sure you'll get a little bit more, maybe not that specific, probably not today as hoped, but you go through the rest of the department's budget, there will be some slides on the network itself. This is the funding mechanism, not the spending side of it, if that helps.
Well, that helps. As some people in this building already know, I took home the big budget binder this weekend and I had all kinds of question marks. But that's not good news for you.
But I'm sure that you'll probably want to spend a day on strategic investments, and sometimes the network is classified as one of those.
Right. Thank you.
I have just one final slide in the section on the state school fund that talks about program outcomes. As you know, very little of the money that goes out, the state school fund money that goes out through the formula, has any strings attached. We give our school districts a great deal of discretion in how they spend their money, recognizing that the needs vary so dramatically around the state from district to district because of their circumstances. But what we have done as a department, and I would argue we do this to hold ourselves accountable, is that we've based our key performance measures on how well students are doing out in the districts, even though we don't have direct control over or any greatly direct influence over student achievement. We believe we can have a powerful indirect effect in the way we do things, assisting in making sure that teacher professional development is effective, making sure the curriculum are well chosen, doing analysis of outcomes to try to understand what helps students and how dollars can be used most effectively. And I think more and more districts appreciate input from the department on what's effective and what's not. We've made a transition from a monitoring and compliance-based agency to one of service. And so we put student achievement at the top of our list of goals.
Senator Roblin?
Yeah, I was just thinking, and I appreciate you putting number five up with the high school graduation, and that goes back to why I think getting good data consistently through the state is really important if we're going to make decisions based on that. And does OEIB use your information on data? I mean, they don't collect their own on graduation rate. They would use the stuff that you collect. Isn't that right?
Co-Chairs Monroe and Comp, Senator Roblin, that's correct. In fact, we work very closely with OEIB. Yeah. They don't collect their own data. They rely on ours very heavily, and we work very closely with them.
Okay. That's what I thought, too. Thanks.
Okay.
How many pages to go?
90
pages to go. Okay.
So we're ready. I think I can make up for some lost ground, and I need to because I, sort of editorialized a couple of times. So youth correction and juvenile detention education programs, we call them YSEP and JDEP. And the youth correction education program is YSEP, and it's things like McLaren, just to sort of give you a reference point of what I'm talking about here. And so it's a standard education program that we provide to youth aged 12 to 21 while they're incarcerated in our 9 youth authority facilities. The average length of stay for those students is 71 days. We serve about 728 students in the program each year, and at any time we have roughly 360 males and 50 females that are part of that system. The students count as 2 students as far as the waiting system is concerned when for compensation for the for the school wait, basically, times 2 as opposed to just times 1. The juvenile detention education program is more like a county lockup kind of facility, so juvenile detention. And JDEP, and it's the education program in juvenile detention centers for youth 12 to 18. The average length of stay in this program is only 8.3 days, and there are 202 youth in these facilities approximately at any given time. 165 are typically young men and 37 are young women, and their funding count as 1.5. These two programs are funded primarily from the state school fund, 88% of the budget, and is on extended ADMW, and then they also receive some federal funds for the kinds of things that they would provide there that would get federal funds, like IDEA, neglected delinquent funding. The current service level is $18.7 million, 16.5 of those from the general fund and 2.2 from federal funds. This is a slide that shows the outcomes for students in YSEP. You can see that they're relatively low when compared to other kinds of outcomes that you would see in the state, typically with the exception perhaps of reading. This graph shows reading, math, science, and writing. You can see there was increased achievement generally across the board in the 10-11 school year, and then they've remained relatively steady over time, relatively flat or slight increases with the exception of reading.
There's a reason why they're in those facilities.
Yes. The YSEP program, when you look at the cohort graduation rate, the 5-year cohort and the 4-year cohort rate, you'll see that they've increased over time. Last year, the 4-year cohort was 28.5%, and the 5-year was 47.5%. And now I'm going to move on to programs for children with disabilities. So as you saw previously, the division at the Oregon Department of Education with the largest budget is student services. And this area is responsible for programs for children with disabilities. At the Oregon School for the Deaf, we provide direct services to children with disabilities. And everywhere else, there are other providers through grants, contracts, and distribution of federal funds. They include a wide variety of programs like early learning, early intervention, early childhood special education, regional programs, hospital programs, pediatric nursing facilities, long-term care and treatment, and the Blind and Visually Impaired Fund.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rob, can you get us the student population of the School of the Deaf and how much per student the biennial cost is? To have them there?
Co-chairs Compton and Rowe, Representative Huffman, yes, I can. And there are 117 students at the Oregon School for the Deaf, and I'll be covering some more of that as I move forward. And I can get you the, I don't think I have in this deck the per student cost, but I certainly can get that for you.
Thank you.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Co-chair. Are we going to be talking about the school just a little bit? Because I know you and I had some conversations a couple years ago about achievement and stuff, and I'd love to see that that's really coming together and great things are happening.
Co-chairs Compton, Rural Representative Springer, yes. We'll get very specific about the School for the Deaf, hopefully today.
Okay.
We'll see.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing, because a couple years ago, or when you first came on, you were shocked at the low achievement levels there. So we'll want to take a look at that, whether it's improving or not.
Co-Chair Monroe, yes, and we'll go right over the top of that. Okay. IDEA, the Individual with Disability Education Act, and federal special education programs, and I'll providing you with program and budget detail for each of these over the course of the next few dozen slides. You'll see here on this chart that there are general funds. other state funds and federal funds that make up resources for these programs, for each of the programs that I just talked about. So, for example, on the top, if you look at early intervention, early childhood special education, you see that the state general fund contributes $146.4 million, federal funds $28 million, for a total of $174 million. And then you can do that on all the different ones that I talked about there. The state provides the majority of the funds in each program that's listed, with the exception of IDEA, the Individual Disability Education Act, where the federal government provides the largest of any amount at $254 million. And there's zero in state funding there, and state funds is other funds. There are some other state sources of funds for special education as well. Brian talked about a number of those. One is the high-cost disability. Disabilities account, it's $36 million set aside out of the state school fund for special education students when the cost of their IEP exceeds $30,000 a year, and it covers about 40% of the extra cost for school districts. As you heard earlier, we double count students with an IEP regardless of the services provided, so each student counts twice, and districts receive somewhere in the neighborhood of $14,000 for a student with an IEP. There's a cap of 11% for the identification of special education students eligible for the double weight. It's currently funded with, there is also an amount that districts can apply for if they're over the 11% cap, and that's currently funded at about $42 million, which is also a set aside out of the state school fund, and districts receive a portion of that as well, somewhere around 40 cents on the dollar. We currently use $2 million in federal IDEA funds in an effort to scale up across the state an effective methodology for properly identifying students with disabilities. And it's called the Response to Intervention Program, and we call it the Oregon Response to Intervention Program. And it's run through a contract with the Tiger 12 school districts, and nearly 90 districts have now benefited from this program statewide. We also have $2 million request in our budget through House Bill 3232 to continue delivery of an expanded RTI scale-up program that was expanded over the course of the last 2 years. We have early childhood or early intervention, early childhood special education, or EIECSE, as it's commonly referred to. Early childhood special education is mandated at both the federal and state level. The actual services are provided in 8 regions across the state through education service districts, or ESDs, or school districts. ODE administers the contracts and provides technical assistance for these programs. They serve infants, toddlers, and preschoolers who have disabilities or developmental delays. The goal is to identify and begin addressing those disabilities as early as possible to increase school readiness and provide community resources for families.
Representative Smith Warner has a question.
Sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hate to interrupt your flow because you're going great. So these are not administered through the early learning hubs.
Co-Chairs Compton Rowe, Representative Smith Warner, no, it is not. It is the one part of early learning, or the early learning that is not, and the challenge there, and there's been a lot of debate about whether or not it should be in the hubs and actually in the, division at the department instead of in the special education division where it currently rests. And it's a difficult discussion. We even had a task force that took a look at it and made some recommendations actually to keep it where it is. And part of, rationale is that all of the legalities that govern this are special education directed. And so any kind of statute or rule or federal law that governs this is all about special education. And the state board typically has overseen that and made any rule that would respond to it. And so we also have the Early Learning Council and the Early Learning Division, and it, for both groups to be making rule around special education could get very messy in a hurry, and so that's why I think it ended up staying where it is. Certainly, because that's all part of the Department of Education now, the coordination and communication that's taking place is much stronger than it ever has been in this area.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you.
I didn't know Smith Warner had a follow-up.
Oh, no. No,
okay. Rob, this is, when we talked early on, seems like it's been a month ago, but when we talked about the $85 million that is in your budget for the early learning hubs, this allocation of $7,419 per child is separate from that $85 million.
Co-chair Comp, I believe that's correct, yes.
Boy, how are we supposed to keep all this straight, Doug?
Doug's working on
it. Once we get to it, I have a chart for you, Madam Chair.
Oh, good. Thank you.
Thank you. So the caseload in this program has grown since the 1990s and most recently served an average of 11,108 students in 2013-14, 74.19 per student was the allocation in 13-15, an increase of just 5.3% over the past 10 years. As a result, the program has grown, but funding hasn't kept up with the cost and service levels have declined. The major cost drivers include an increase in the numbers of students requiring high-cost services, such as children with autism. The 15-17 budget includes $6.7 million for an assumed annual caseload growth of 5% in early intervention and 1% in early childhood special education. Our proposed budget includes an additional $15 million for early intervention, early childhood special education.
So if I add Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
So if I have $85 million and another $15 million, I think that's $100 million for this age group of children.
Madam Chair, I think the $85 million you're referring to is probably the Early Reading Initiative, which is slightly different. There is another, I'm going to pick out a figure of $90 million that might be a little off for various early learning initiatives proposed in the governor's budget.
Okay, I'll wait till I can understand it. Thank you.
We're under federal restrictions, public law 94-142 from 30 years ago or whenever it was. Does that hamper you, or are you able to work around the regulations of the feds?
Co-Chair Monroe, I'm not certain that I understood the question. Everything about early intervention, early childhood special education, and IDEA are all part of the same federal law.
Yeah.
And so the any of the requirements or rule or law is similar throughout the system, really birth through 12.
Yeah. Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A clarification there. Does the districts have a maintenance of effort requirement? Is there a maintenance of effort requirement in early childhood in this particular thing with respect to the same?
Co-Chairs Kaufman, Rowe, Senator Roblin. I don't know the answer to that question specifically. There is a maintenance of effort rule for the state in overall dollars that are attributable to special education year over year. I don't know that it carves it out specifically by age group.
Okay.
I'm sure I can come back with that tomorrow.
But it goes to your tying your hands idea that I...
Yeah, that's... Yeah.
Okay, so... Yes, I think I covered that. Here's just a graph of the caseload growth. And you can see that the growth in numbers of children that we're serving each year through the visual representation. The darker portion of each graph indicates numbers of infants and toddlers in early intervention, and a lighter color the numbers of children in early childhood special education. The total is just over 11,000.
Go ahead.
Does that correspond with actual population growth as opposed to others? Because we've been growing at around 5% as a state, and I'm just wondering if that is correspondingly the increase. So it's not something that we've identified more. It's just that their portion of the population growth is pretty consistent.
Co-Chairs Compton, Senator Roblin, I don't know the answer exactly. I'm sure we can take a look at population growth and then this growth. We do know that with the advent of the early learning hubs, that the numbers of students that, one of the purposes, one of the things that we're attempting to accomplish is to do robust identification early so that we can intervene early and change long-term outcome, and that we believe that we're going to see a pretty good jump in the numbers of students who are identified with either developmental delays or some other kind of specific learning disability. You can see here year-over-year spending increases and that the state provides the majority of the funding for these early intervention programs with a current service level number of $146 million and a federal level of $28 million. So the dark blue is the general funds and then the red is the federal funds. And in 2009-11, the reason we have that pointed out is that there were some American Recovery and Reinvestment Act dollars that were contributed there, and so it sort of looked like an anomaly. And it is, but for that reason. So,
Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it appears that the federal government's condition that they would impose these new things and pay it fully has not quite been recognized.
Co-chairs Compton Monroe, Senator Roblin, that's correct. I think that the federal government, when IDEA was passed, said that they would fund it at 40%, and the highest that they've ever gotten is 16%. So it was one of those laws that was passed, and they had a target, and they just, I think, have given up on ever actually achieving it.
And that was, wasn't that passed in the mid-70s?
Co-chair Monroe, yes, it was. PL 94-142, I think, was passed in 76, yep. Something like that, yeah.
I was a very young man.
We all had to memorize that day.
Yeah.
All children identified as having a disability or developmental delay receive services through this program. So if you're identified, you receive services. We set a service level target for each child, and at this point in time, however, only 30.4% of those that we serve actually receive the intended service target. So if you're identified, you get something. We want to fully provide you with what that is. There's detail, like early intervention is one time a week at home or community-based. That would be the service level. Early childhood special education, children with low needs, is one time a week in the child setting, which is home or preschool. If you're moderate, it's 12 hours of preschool, 12 hours with preschool, of preschool per week, and then once a week consultation and a parent visit once a month. That's the intended target. Or if you're high needs, it's 15 hours of preschool per week at a ratio of 1-4, with once a week direct service of PT or OT, occupational therapy or physical therapy, and parent visit once a month. So those are the targets that we have that are identified based on the identification, basically. But we achieve those targets only in about 33% of the cases. Yeah, 30.4%, my apologies. Here we have key performance measure number 2, which was set by the legislature to provide 100% of these children with the service level that's indicated, the service level I just walked through. But as I said, we're not reaching that. The outcomes for the programs are really strong, however. KPM3 had a target for 81% of identified children exiting. And we met that target, 82.7%, meeting the definition of the child is exited into school age within age level standards or made significant progress while enrolled in the program. So while we're not meeting the service level, the outcome that we get for KPM3, we're actually exceeding. So it's kind of an interesting dynamic there, but I like the outcome part. School-age special education. There were just fewer than 75,000 school-age K-12 students statewide identified with a learning disability. On this chart, you'll see the 7 broad identification categories for these students and the rough number of each by school age, elementary, middle, or high. So the elementary is the blue, middle school is the red, and the high is chartreuse, I'm going to call it. You can tell I fish. That's chartreuse. You'll see a huge number of students with speech-language issues in elementary, but not in other places. And so the really high blue one right there is because there are lots of students with speech or language impairment when they first enter into elementary school, and that largely those disabilities are overcome with the help of teachers, speech-language path services, and so forth. And it's one of the only disabilities that we really should see that gets overcome. A learning challenge can be moderated, but typically does not completely go away if it's a true disability. So just to give you a sense of what these mean, because they're words that sometimes I look at them, I go, well, what is that exactly? What is an intellectual disability? And so an intellectual disability might be a student with who has Down syndrome. Other health impaired would be things like ADHD. I think I sort of covered the speech or language impairment. Specific learning disability might be something that's specifically diagnosed. Dyslexia is a specific learning disability, for example. And then low incidence would be things that do not take place very often, and it's a broad spectrum of things. Typically, they are relatively profound. So, like blind deaf student would be a low incidence student, or something like spina bifida. And again, the students are typically really highly impacted, but it doesn't occur at a very high rate. We have nearly 8,000 students that are served by eight regional special education program providers, and the largest category served by are students with autism, who make up nearly 6,000 of those students. And so typically these programs are, again, students who have fairly profound needs that come together and receive services. So we would call it high cost, low incidence oftentimes. So it's not, there are not lots of students in any individual district, and that the program services require a high level of intensity. And so if we can bring those students together, we can provide the intensity level. And there, as I said, there are about 8,000 students served in such
Representative Smith
programs.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can I just clarify that those are the same, that's the same division through which EI early special ed is administered as well?
I'm looking back at my special ed folks, but I don't know.
They're looking at each other.
So Senator Monroe, Representative Cohen, Representative Smith-Warner. I don't know the answer, but okay. I'll find out.
The eight kind of
I am going to, let me think about that for a second. I'm going to say.
One of your staff
is saying no. Most of them are
saying
no.
Yeah, I'm going to say no. And
that's
we had
good, because that's the way they're nodding back
right,
there.
Right, and we had. Yeah, I'm just thinking back to sort of my own experience where oftentimes EI, ECSE, some of the services are regionalized but through a different regional kind of service provider. So oftentimes there were early intervention, early childhood special education services in the schools where I was the superintendent, but they collected students not just from a single elementary catchment area but from multiple elementary catchment areas. And so that's what that looked like, but they are probably less regionalized than are some of the programs for the students that I'm identifying here that typically have more profound challenges.
And if I may follow up briefly, mainly that what caught my attention on that was that eight was the number for the provision of EIESE, and then eight is also the number regionally for this. So I would also be interested to see where there is kind of how that division compares.
Yes, co-chairs Conference Monroe, Representative Smith-Warner, we can bring that for you. Typically, the eight providers oftentimes are ESDs, and so we have contracts with ESDs, and they have some additional expertise around special education, for example, and so they've scaled that up, but it can also be districts in some cases.
Thank you.
And we're pretty much out of time. Is this a good place to break?
Co-Chair Monroe, this would be great.
Okay, why don't we do that? Madam Co-Chair?
Just a comment before we take public testimony again tomorrow. I've heard from several legislators already this morning, and yes, there was an article in the Oregonian. The pages that Brian Reeder gave us about the formula revenue, it's kind of small print, but you can see what the different grants are, the transportation, general purpose. But it also shows that, you know, there's not a lot of variation in a lot when you get to the total formula ADMW. It really narrows the space, and which is what the formula is designed to do. But I would keep this sheet close to your phone when you're local superintendents call you and say, well, now what information are you looking at? So,
yeah, it's pretty clear that there's been some misinformation out there, and I would encourage you to use the numbers that we get from Doug. I would think that they're probably going to be more accurate.
Mm-hmm.
I think your district by district numbers are coming from the Legislative Revenue Office.
Okay.
And the numbers are out there, to be fair, work from different bases, for a lack of a better term, and that's what drives some of the differences, assumptions around local revenue and other things.
Okay, tomorrow we are in hearing room C, and we'll be hearing from some of the folks that didn't get a chance to testify last Tuesday and Wednesday. So we will see you there at 8:30, and we're adjourned.
Thank you.
How many slides did we get through today?
Thank you.
How many slides did we get through today?